Good day, everyone, and welcome to the H-1B Visas and the Senate Immigration Bill's Impact on High-Tech Companies conference call. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. For opening remarks and introductions, I would now like to turn this conference over to Stuart Anderson, Executive Director, National Foundation for American Policy. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Stuart Anderson, and Executive Director of the National Foundation for American Policy, which is a nonpartisan public policy research organization started in 2003, focusing primarily on trade and immigration. The study we're releasing today on H-1B can be found on our website at www.nfap.com. I used to be staff director of the Senate Immigration Subcommittee and head of policy and commissioner of the INS, and that's where I met Bo Cooper, who will also be on the call. Bo served as general counsel of the INS in the Clinton and Bush administration, and today advises tech companies as an attorney at Paul Hastings. I'm going to give highlights of the study, make some comments on the study, but we also thought it would be very helpful to have a discussion of some of the parts of the Senate bill and their impact on tech firms, because not all of that has been known. And so we also asked, in addition to Bo, Amy Burks, who's Director of Government Relations at Texas Instruments, to say a few words. She was kind of a late addition here. As you know, Congress has not increased the annual H-1B cap for years, resulting in companies exhausting the supply of H-1B visas before the start of the past four fiscal years. The study, in part, responds to arguments made against raising the H-1B cap. I'm going to sum up some of the key findings of the study. First, H-1B professionals are highly skilled and important to company competitiveness. 57% of new H-1B professionals in 2006 earned a master's degree or higher, and in 2005, U.S. universities awarded 55% of master's degrees and 67% of PhDs in electrical engineering to foreign nationals. So when companies recruit, often on college campuses, they find qualified Americans, but they also find many foreign nationals. Second, the study found no evidence, really, of increased H-1B visa abuses, as some have alleged. In examining enforcement data, the analysts found only modest problems. In fact, the back wages owed to H-1B employees via enforcement actions actually declined from FY 2005 to 2006, covering up $0.6 million in back wages. To give an idea how small $4.6 million is in the context of a $12 trillion economy, it's about what Roger Clemens won a month pitching for the New York Yankees this year. Now, it's worth noting that in DOL investigations, approximately 90% of the cases have been found to be paperwork offenses or misread employer obligations, not willful violations. And of these dozen or so willful violations, which are more serious violations, none have been committed by companies with what we would consider household names. Third, there isn't much evidence H-1B visas are a significant source of, quote, outsourced jobs from the U.S., even though this issue has received a lot of attention recently. The 10 companies most cited as allegedly using up most of the H-1B visas and causing the, quote, outsourcing of U.S. jobs to India and elsewhere actually used fewer than 15 in new H-1B visas in 2006, which is less than 14% of the new H-1B petitions that were approved that year for initial employment, according to data we obtained from the U.S. Immigration Services. Now, this approximately 15,000 comes to less than 0.01% of the U.S. labor force and less than 4% of the 440,000 people employed by these 10 companies worldwide. I mean, just to add a little more perspective here, since 2003, the number of net new jobs in America increased by over 8 million, and that the Bureau of Labor Statistics projects growth of about 100,000 a year in jobs in math, science, occupations between 2004 and 2014. Now, companies inevitably will follow the talent, so overall it's probably ironic to be concerned about outsourcing in the context of H-1Bs, since denying companies access to foreign-born professionals because there's a lack of the H-1B visas probably does more to encourage U.S. employers to build up their human resources outside the country than any other U.S. policy. Fourth, USI tunnels are actually doing very well economically as a group. Software engineers have the best jobs in America, as a quote, according to a 2006 Money Magazine survey. American professionals in math and computer occupations are at virtual full employment with a low annual unemployment rate of 2.4% in 2006 and salary growth of about 2.4% a year as well. If one focuses just on the category of programmers, the current low unemployment rate of 2.8% in that category means approximately that fewer than 17,000 computer programmers nationwide are unemployed, with the vast majority facing frictional unemployment simply between jobs or located in the wrong geographic area or possessing the wrong skill set. I mean, there's no evidence that this rate would be lower even if the U.S. stopped entry of all PD professionals. On education, U.S. businesses pay over $91 billion a year in state and local taxes directed toward public education, and the mandated scholarship and training fees U.S. companies pay for each H-1B professional hired is now approaching a total of $2 billion since 1999. Also, companies have paid about $300 million in anti-fraud fees in just the past 2 years. Finally, I'm going to mention a issue that has come up, in that the study focused on some attention on a bill by Senators Durbin and Grassley that would put a lot of new labor conditions on the use of H-1B visas. And this is very important because several of these provisions that are discussed in the study actually became part of the final Senate bill language that's going to be debated. So it's actually, many of the provisions are actually part of the underlying bill. Bo Cooper will talk a little bit more about those, but I thought it would just be interesting to note that then in looking at the Durbin-Grassley bill itself, there is a group of H-1B visa holders called Immigration Voice, and in theory, these provisions in the Durbin-Grassley bill would be designed to protect them. They actually said that, and I quote, that the measures would make it virtually impossible for employees to seek new jobs if they are on H-1B visas because of all the conditions and strings imposed on filing H-1B petitions. So to sum up, the headline finding is that H-1B professionals fill key niches in the U.S. while they do help to keep jobs and innovation inside the United States. We're now going to hear from Bo Cooper, who's going to be able to talk a little more in depth about the Senate bill. Bo?
Yes, thank you very much, Stuart. As the debate around this bill is being framed in the last couple of days, one interesting aspect of that framing is that you've seen a lot of people talk about how, you know, the bill has a lot of problems, and one of its problems is that it's slanted excessively toward the higher skilled and more highly educated. But on a closer examination, this bill is not at all the full remedy for the crisis facing talent acquisition in the United States that many are perceiving it to be. And I want to just talk for a few minutes about what exactly is in the bill and then make a few observations. So to begin with the H-1B side, as Stuart was describing, there was a great deal of public attention on the fact that this year, for the first time in the history of the program, the entire supply for the coming fiscal year of H-1Bs ran out on the very first day. Not the first day of the year, the first day that you could apply for the visas, 6 months in advance of the start of the fiscal year. There's never been such a dramatic mismatch between the demand and the supply of these visas. The bill, and that base supply in today's law, is 65,000. There are 65,000 H-1Bs available, and there are certain exemptions from that cap. There's a limited exemption for people who have advanced degrees from U.S. institutions. There are exemptions for universities and nonprofit research organizations and so on. The bill would revise the H-1B program, raising the cap from 65,000 by 50 to 115,000 per year. It also would provide what's being called a market escalator, so that if the cap were hit, there'd be a graduated increase to the cap in succeeding years if it continues to run out. And then that escalator is itself capped at 180,000. It could never escalate above 180,000 visas per year. A couple of points on both the increase in the base amount and on the market-based escalator is that while the market-based escalator is certainly a helpful addition, it's only a fairly modest one because 180,000, its top potential peak, is still a good 15,000 fewer than the H-1B limit that Congress of 195,000 as recently as just 5 years ago. The second thing, and this is the more dramatic, even the fifth visa increase to 115,000, that would guarantee that the supply that ran out on the very first day this year would also run out on the very first day next year, assuming the same or a higher demand. DHS got over 115,000 petitions for H-1Bs this year on the first day. So the increase, though it is an important increase, would not expand the supply an additional 24 hours. And employers would still be facing a situation where they're looking at a year and a half blackout period on the ability to bring in new H-1Bs. One thing that's very surprising about the formulation that is in the bill is it leaves out a key piece of H-1 that was passed by the Senate last year by a wide margin and with bipartisan support. Both in what passed last year, as well as in the skill bill that Senator Cornyn recently reintroduced, as well as the STRIVE Act that was introduced on the House side by Representatives Flake and Gutierrez, all of those formulations of H-1B reform included adding exemptions from the cap for certain especially prized categories of workers, those who have U.S. advanced degrees and those who have earned degrees overseas in occupations in fields that are especially badly needed, science, technology, engineering, and math. And, you know, those exemptions are meant to line up with the educational reality that Stuart was describing, that we're just not producing enough of those enough experts in those fields in the U.S. Those exemptions, for some reason, are not included in the bill that the senators in the White House have and will be debated in the coming week or weeks. And without those exemptions, as I was mentioning before, the H-1B supply would run out on the very first day, even at its elevated level. A couple of other features of the H-1B provisions in the bill. One is that under the bill, H-1B applicants would be presumed to intend to work in the United States permanently when they apply for their H-1B. And if they're not able to overcome or disprove that presumption, they would be ineligible to receive the visa and inadmissible to the United States. Today, they do not have that presumption. It's called a presumption of immigrant intent. But the bill would impose that presumption on them and just add one more hurdle to a person who's seeking to come and work in a specialty as a professional in a specialty occupation. And that's a very serious new obstacle. It's not clear to me what problem they're trying to solve with this, but it's a very serious new obstacle. Likewise, there is a new requirement that an absolute requirement that H-1Bs must have a bachelor's or higher degree in the specific specialty from a U.S. Or recognized foreign institution. Now, of course, having a degree is usually the dividing line between eligibility for an H-1B and non-eligibility. But there are certain situations which it's possible under current law, very rare ones and difficult to achieve, but certain situations where it's possible to show that you've got the equivalent of a degree based on a combination of school and experience. And also it is possible to qualify for an H-1B if your degree is related and important to the field that you're going to work in, but that might it's very common for people's professional experience to take them in a somewhat different from the degree that they received. And this would make the H-1B unavailable to people in either of those two situations. Then, as Stuart mentioned, there's an extensive series of new enforcement provisions, and I think it's fair to say that the tech community is entirely behind the notion that it's better for the system if abusers of the program are identified and penalized and prevented from misuse of the H-1B, and the H-1B program has extensive compliance rules. And a lot of the provisions, the new enforcement provisions, are aimed at expanding the ability of the government to investigate and to identify and to penalize misuse of the program. But there are certain very startling features of this, one dominant of which is a new rule that would treat all H-1B employers today, all H-1B employers after reform, under the rules that today apply only to those who have willfully violated program requirements. And it's a very, very complex and burdensome set of requirements for proving U.S. recruitment and what's called non-displacement, that for the year surrounding the hire, either before or after, 6 months before or 6 months after, the H-1B has not, quote, displaced a U.S. worker. And this is one of those kinds of requirements that seems to make on its surface. But when you actually go into what the regulatory regime is for compliance with this, it's incredibly burdensome. And you know, Congress has rightly thought that it shouldn't be a burden borne by legitimate employers. It should only be borne by those who have violated H-1B requirements or who are called H-1B dependent, because that is, have an important portion of H-1Bs in their workforce. But that is a new requirement that's coming to every H-1B employer if it's enacted. And finally, I just wanted to note that the bill's provisions for green cards is also quite problematic from the standpoint of the employers of the highly skilled, largely because now the system would be entirely applicant-driven. Today's system is employer-driven. That is, employers decide what their specific hiring needs are, and they recruit and they sponsor green cards on the basis of those specific needs. This would reverse the tables so that workers would be the ones who present themselves to the system. And you know, that might very well often result in a match between what employers' needs are and the skills and the pool of people getting green cards, but it's a very difficult match to control under the new applicant-driven system. So that's some of the highlights of the bill, and now I think it makes sense to turn it over to Amy.
Thanks. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about how TI uses the H-1B and the green card programs, and then address some of the specific concerns with the bill. We use the H-1B program primarily to hire foreign nationals who have advanced degrees in science and engineering. The majority of these are from U.S. universities. If you look at the graduates from U.S. programs, for example, in electrical engineering, which is very core to our business, over half of the master's degrees and 71% of the PhDs awarded in 2006 were to foreign nationals. Now, these are the pool of applicants that we're looking at when we recruit on U.S. campuses. They're the types of individuals that are very key to us continuing our product innovation and being able to sustain our manufacturing facilities, that we have 7 of those in the United States. TI has a policy of filing for permanent resident or green card status for all of our H-1B because we want these individuals to make a career with our company. But the green card is plagued, as Beau mentioned, with backlogs, and we have hundreds of employees right now that are looking at 5-7 year waits or longer. It's very frustrating for our employees. They're in personal and professional limbo, and it really limits their promotion and mobility options. Some have chosen to return home or pursue careers in other countries that have more welcoming policies. What we'd really like to see Congress do is address the shortages on the H-1B side and on the green card side. Ideally, this would be through exemptions, as Beau mentioned, in the Strive and Skill Acts that exempt advanced degree candidate in some of these key disciplines. We also have some concerns over the additional burdens that the Dribbin-Grassley provisions make on the H-1B program that really makes a broken system even worse for high-tech employers.
Okay, well, thank you. Now we'd like to open up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Andrews. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach the equipment. Once again, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Our first question comes from Patrick Thibodeau from Computer World. Please go ahead.
Hi. I guess a question for Bo. Hopefully I'm not on mute.
No, I got you, Patrick. Thanks.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the first thing is in the new bill, in the Senate bill, they would have to state, the applicant would have to, that they intend to stay in the U.S. permanently applying for a green card?
No, actually it's the reverse. It is that the applicant, when the applicant goes before a consular officer or is trying to come in at an airport, the U.S. Government official would have to presume that they are trying to come in permanently, which is not permitted in most temporary visa categories. In other words, there's a rule today that says unless you have a green card, then you cannot be admitted to the let me back up. There's a rule today that that a person who intends to come here permanently is not admissible unless they've got a green card. And there's a corollary that says that every person who presents themselves to the system is presumed to be trying to come here permanently. So you've got to overcome that presumption, and you intend to go home at the end of the day in order to get a temporary visa. That presumption today doesn't apply, though, to H's, and the new bill would apply that presumption to H's. So it's one more obstacle for an H to overcome, and it's also totally inconsistent with, you know, with what Amy was describing, which is the business reality that that you know the H has become. And is properly considered as a to bring in workers whom we want to bring into the workforce permanently rather than temporarily.
On the exemption issue, right? The exemptions disappear for the or that separate little category disappears for the 20,000, and it's bundled into the overall cap.
No, I understand that 20,000 exemption to remain
for the.
For U.S. advanced degrees.
So is that the
That's right.
But that's actually still not sufficient in that we did hit that within a couple of weeks.
But you would be able to under the cap, you would get this under this proposal, you would get the increase that's outlined in there. Plus, you would still get the 20,000.
That's right.
All right.
And that's contrasted with what the Senate passed last year, which would have an exemption for those advanced degree holders, but it wouldn't be limited to 20,000.
All right. Okay, I might have some other questions, but that's it for now.
Great.
Okay, next question.
Our next question comes from Deborah Bulkley. Please go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on the new green card process. As it was described last week, it seemed like that would maybe help the high industry by basing, you know, who by basing immigration on who has these skills. I mean, what is your take on that?
I think the real concern is that, yes, it's correct that the way that the point allocation has been devised by the negotiators, it has been devised so that it's favorable toward those who have high skill levels and high educational levels. I think the employer community's real concern is that when it is workers who self-petition rather than employers who are deciding what the particular needs are in its workforce, then there's a loss of control over what kinds of skill sets get presented to the system and get approved. So, you know, think about, for example, the fact that the diversity visa lottery that exists today, mm-hmm. there are up to 50,000 slots for what's called the diversity green card mm-hmm. lottery, and I think somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 million applications tend to come in for those 50,000 slots. You know, the number of applications that are going to come in under this new, when it's not an employer-driven system, when it's an applicant-driven system, I think it's fair to anticipate that the numbers of applicants are going to be astronomical. And when that happens, Congress has not Congress has essentially given up its system of deciding by skill set and by skill category what sorts of workers we want to admit into the U.S. And it's just going to be a far more random and uncontrolled process that is determined by who makes an application to the system.
Deborah, I think I think the headline on this is that companies want to hire specific skilled people, not skilled people in general. And I think that's kind of the flaw in the point system. And the other thing is that there's no evidence that, you know, companies or really very many people at all were pushing for this particular type of system opposed to employment-based and family-based. You know, what was really happening was as the price to buy into the legalization, there were folks who wanted to cut family immigration, and this was their way to cut family immigration. I mean, I think that's pretty obvious because that's, you know, because they literally take the numbers from the different family categories that will be eliminated and put them into the pool to make up what they're calling MEDIS. So that's really what we're talking about here. It really wasn't devised, you know, in close consultation with anyone who was interested in, you know, in trying to really try to help, the U.S. high-tech economy, for example.
So it's losing the employer's control that you're concerned about then?
Yes, that's right. And by control, we mean the ability to select the specific skill sets are needed in the workforce.
Well,
and one interesting thing on that is that...
Right? I mean, you mean to keep a particular person that you want, because that person you might want might not be able to get the points.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. But one interesting thing to note is that Australia, I mean, people who are proponents of this change keep saying, well, you know, Australia does this and it works beautifully. Australia's got a point system. If it's good enough for them, why isn't it good enough for us? But Australia actually has a big component of its economic immigration that's fulfilled by what are called employer-sponsored petitions. And so Australia does precisely what we're suggesting should remain a feature of the U.S. system. That is where it's employers who decide what workers are needed.
Okay, thanks.
Next question.
Jim Huizenga from the Los Angeles Times.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about how some of these issues directed at other parts of the immigration system in terms of immigration reform have impacted the H-1B visa issue. You just talked about the desire to cut back on family and immigration and how that sort of had a spillover effect on H-1B visas. How overall are some of the concerns that the bill is trying to address in terms of immigration overall, how are they negative impacts on the unique requirements of H-1B visas?
Bo, did you want to, I guess you can talk a little bit about what you've talked about within the bill.
Yeah, I mean, I think Stuart captured it best when he was describing the way that, you know, the interaction between some of the family-based numbers and the rest of the debate. I mean, it certainly is the case that there's an increase on H-1Bs. It's not one that's calculated to meet the demands of the economy today. And then if you look at a lot of the other provisions that are being inserted with respect to H-1Bs, you know, I think they're driven by the premise that this bill has got to be a lot tougher if it's going to be proper immigration reform. And, you know, that's a premise that has been applied really, I mean, that came control context. And I think it's bleeding over into the H-1B context far beyond any evidence of levels of misuse that would justify it.
Right. I would put it this way. As the bill stands now, I would think the bill is pretty much a disaster for high-tech employers. Next question.
question comes from Mark Sheff with Crane's Workforce Management.
Yes, I actually have a question that follows on that last answer. If you think it is a disaster for high-tech employers, where in the process are you going to try, or do you think you have the best chance of making changes? Is it in the Senate floor debate, or over in the House, or in the conference committee? What's your legislative strategy?
We're a think tank, so we don't get involved in that aspect. So I was probably speaking more freely than the other folks would in terms of characterizing the bill, but I'll let them kind of answer what they think on legislative strategy.
This is Bill. I mean, I can say that that you know, obviously, the earlier in the process it can be changed, the better. And so, you know, we'll have a sharp focus on the Senate floor at this point, and see what we can accomplish there. And then what we can't accomplish there, we'll continue to work on in the House.
Amy, do you have anything to?
No, I would just concur with what Bo said.
Yep. Next question comes from Jim Rowley from Bloomberg.
I'm wondering whether or not anyone can, this may apply more to low-tech industry than high-tech, but is there anybody there who has any views on the liability provisions for checking and verifying that someone that you've hired is indeed a U.S. citizen? And for the sanctions for doing that, for ending up, you know, being the victim of identity fraud or some other deception by the person who's come to work for you.
Yeah, I think it's outside the scope of what we've been principally focused on. With respect to the lower skilled workers, I do want to emphasize that you know, our goal is not at all to grab numbers away from needed workers in different skill levels. Our goal is simply to make Congress aware of what's needed to address the crisis in talent acquisition at higher skill levels, and to get Congress to enact provisions that would fix those problems.
I do not, on the verification side, there are some concerns about the workability of the system, and I would refer you to Lynn Shotwell at ACIP. I believe that she's working with the coalition for this issue.
Thank you.
Other questions at this time, Mr. Anderson?
I'm sorry?
There are no further questions at this time.
Okay. Do you want to put it out again, or if there's no other questions, I think we'll wrap up the call. The study is on the website at www.nfap.com. If you're looking for who exactly was on this call, if you joined it late, again, I'm Stuart Anderson, Executive Director of the Foundation for American Policy. Bo Cooper is an attorney with Paul Hastings, and Amy Burks is Director of Government Relations at Texas Instruments. Thank you all for participating in the call, and thank you.
Mr. Anderson?
Yes.
We did have two additional questions come up.
So. Oh, okay. Terrific.
First one is from Mr. Patrick Thibodeau with Computer World.
Hi, listen, thanks again for another opportunity for a question. This is, I guess, Amy Burke, help me with this one. I understand exactly what you're saying about the engineering part. But one of the things that you hear too within, which is part and parcel with this, with the H-1B, is its use for purely for offshoring of certain skill sets, like, you know, Infosys and whatnot. They may be hired by a company to basically outsource an entire help desk. So all the help desk workers will lose their jobs. H-1B workers will come in and work in those positions. And then, you know, the jobs will disappear overseas. And, you know, we've seen repeated instances of that. So how do you reconcile, like, what you want, you know, what you see as your need, your effort to get, you know, engineering talent out of the skills, with the complaints from the other side that says that the H-1B is really just used to facilitate job loss for certain classes of workers?
I think I'd actually rather have Stuart answer that, because I believe that he focused a lot more on from the report on that piece. I can really only speak to you know, how TI needs to use the program, but I believe that the report contains some information on this particular point.
Sure, Patrick. No, I mean, it's, you know, there obviously is a tension between different types of employers, and you know, some of the employer community obviously you know, it just has, you know, using the visa somewhat differently than others. And so the irony, though, is that the legislative proposals actually, while Senator Durbin has actually focused most of his attention attacking what he called the outsourcing use of H-1B visas, which our study shows really is kind of exaggerated to the extent it's happening at all, is actually all the labor provisions apply to all the companies. So, you know, so I don't know what the exact reason for that is. One of the reasons maybe is that the companies that, like you mentioned, like Infosys, actually a lot of these labor provisions already apply to them. So it's kind of like I can't put any more provisions on them, or I can only put so many more provisions on them. Let me use that as part of a reason to put it on all employers. So there's kind of a disconnect, between the criticism of the outsourcing and what actually was put in the underlying bill. Even on this other provision that Bo had talked about the what's called dual intent, I mean, the main criticism on the outsourcing aspect is that people come in temporarily for a year or so on a project and then they go back to work in, work in India, for example. Ironically, under this provision and change in the law, you wouldn't be able to have H-1Bs have the intent to come here and stay permanently. So there's a real disconnect between some of the criticisms that have been lodged on H-1Bs and what's actually in the underlying bill.
And if I could just add a couple more points. There are two provisions in the bill that are aimed at certain kinds of company models, and one of those provisions would forbid employers from recruiting H-1B workers only. Those provisions would forbid any company that has 50 or more employees from having over half of its workforce on H-1B visas. And so those are provisions that are aimed by their sponsors at some kinds of business models that are considered to be counterproductive for the U.S. workforce. The other thing is that one thing that's absolutely clear is that the vast majority of H-1Bs are used in this country in ways that generate additional employment, not that takes it away. If you look at companies, for example, they have only a very, very small percentage of H-1Bs by comparison with their entire workforce. But you know, that's one of the biggest drivers in our economy today, and biggest creators of U.S. jobs.
Did we have another question?
Our next question comes from Mark Sheff with Cranesworth.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking an extra question. I just had one more for Amy Burks. If the Senate bill were to get through intact in terms of the provisions that affect high-tech companies, how would it force Texas Instruments to change its operations? What differences might we see? Are there specifics you could give in terms of where you might siphon and so on?
It certainly is going to affect it on an employee-by-employee basis.
Mm-hmm.
We have several hundred employees right now that are waiting for their green cards. So the lack of increase there and lack of exemptions, if that were to go through, would be very detrimental to us in that these folks have already been waiting for several years. I can't really address whether we would hiring decisions outside, but you know, you do have to get a little creative in being able to hire the people that you want from U.S. universities, and we may have to do some things like have people at and off an overseas location for a short period of time until we're able to have enough numbers to bring them in to the U.S.
Okay, well, I appreciate all the participation, and certainly, if there's additional questions, you can call 703-351-5042 or send us an email, which you should be able to get off the website, and the website, again, is www.nfap.com. Again, thank you to Bo and Amy for participating and for everyone else on the call. Thank you.
That does conclude our call for today. And we again thank you for your participation. Have a great day.